Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really zeroing in on something pretty fundamental, how we actually gather knowledge in behavioral science.
Right.
You know, you hear about studies all the time, the ones in the news, maybe influencing decisions, trying to help us figure out why we do what we do. Mm-hmm. But have you ever really stopped to think about the nuts and bolts, how that info is collected?
It's so key, isn't it? Understanding the methodology. It's really the first step if you want to make sense of any research finding.
Exactly.
And that's what we're tackling today. We're going to draw from our sources and break down two really core approaches, experimental studies and observational studies.
Think of it like a backstage pass to how research gets done. We'll look at what makes them tick, their strengths, and yeah, maybe some of their weaknesses too.
Sound good?
So let's dive right in. Experiments. What fundamentally is experimental research?
Well, in essence, experimental research is all about cause and effect, trying to establish it anyway. Mm-hmm. Researchers actively, you know, introduce some kind of change and then watch to see what happens, what the consequences are.
So it's different from just like watching things.
Yeah, it's different from non-experimental research, which often looks at relationships, sure, but not necessarily where one thing is directly causing another.
Right. So the key thing is you're actively doing something, manipulating something.
Precisely. The absolute defining feature is manipulating an independent variable. Let's call it the IV, to see what effect it has on a dependent variable, the DV.
The IV is what you change. The DV is what you measure.
You got it. The independent variable is what researchers tweak or alter. And the dependent variable is what they measure to see if that tweak made a difference.
Okay, that makes sense. Like, if you wanted to see if a new kind of teaching method improves test scores, the teaching method is the IV and the scores are the DV.
Perfect example.
But hang on, what about all the other things that could affect scores? Like how much students studied beforehand or, I don't know, their general aptitude?
Ah, good point. Those are what we call extraneous variables.
Extraneous variables.
Yeah, all those other factors, they could potentially influence the dependent variable, the test scores in your example. If you don't control them, they can create noise, static.
Make it hard to see if the teaching method actually worked.
Exactly. Or even worse, they could actually mislead you into thinking the method worked when it was really something else entirely. They can be confounding factors.
Okay, so how do researchers try and like quiet that static? How do you manage these extraneous variables?
Well, there are a few main ways. One is just trying to hold them constant.
Like making sure everyone studies the same amount, which sounds hard.
It can be, yeah. But you try to keep those factors from changing across your different groups. Another way is using matched groups.
Matched groups.
So you try to make sure the participants in your different conditions are similar on key things that might matter. Like maybe matching them on initial aptitude scores in your teaching example.
Okay.
But probably the most powerful technique, the gold standard really, is random assignment.
Random assignment. Right. That's where everyone joining the study has an equal chance of ending up in any of the groups. Yeah.
That's absolutely it. By randomly assigning people, you're basically shuffling the deck.
Okay.
You're trying to spread out all those pre-existing differences, aptitude, motivation, whatever, evenly across the groups. So hopefully those differences kind of cancel each other out.
So it's less likely that one group just happened to be, say, smarter to begin with.
Exactly. It minimizes the chance that those initial differences are the real reason for any change you see, rather than the IV you manipulated.
Okay, super important. So we've got our variables, IV and DV, and we're trying to control the extraneous stuff. Now, what about these different conditions or groups you mentioned?
Right. So in an experiment, you'll typically have different conditions or groups. You've got your treatment group, that's the one getting the actual intervention, the thing you're testing.
The new teaching method group.
Yep. And then you need something to compare them to, right? Those are the control groups. They act as a baseline.
Okay.
And there are different flavors of control groups. You might have a no treatment group that just gets nothing related to the IV.
Standard comparison.
Or a placebo group. They might get something that seems like the treatment, like a sugar pill in a drug study. Or maybe an old teaching method in your example. But it lacks the active ingredient.
Controls for the psychological effect of just being in a study.
Exactly. And sometimes you see a waitlist control group. They don't get the treatment during the main study, but they're promised it afterwards.
Ah, okay. So the control group is the benchmark. It tells you if the treatment actually did something specific beyond what might have happened anyway.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Now, experiments can also vary based on how many independent variables they're juggling.
Okay.
A really common one is the single factor two-level design.
Oh.
Sounds technical, but it just means one IV with two conditions, two levels.
Like your teaching method example.
Yep.
New method versus old method. That's one factor. Teaching method with two levels.
Perfect. Or maybe comparing, say, cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, versus no therapy for anxiety. One IV therapy type, two levels, CBT versus none.
Got it. Two groups, one difference being tested.
Then you can also have single factor multi-level designs. Still just one IV, but now you have more than two conditions or levels.
So maybe comparing three teaching methods.
Yeah. Or maybe looking at the effect of different doses of a medication, low dose, medium dose, high dose, plus a placebo, that's one IV medication dose, with four levels. Or like the example in the materials, different frequencies of therapy for depression, weekly, biweekly, monthly.
Okay, so the IV can have sort of different amounts or types being tested. Now, the materials also talk about between subject and within subject designs. What's the core difference there?
Yeah, that's about who experiences the conditions. Mm. In a between subject experiment, you have different people in each condition.
Different groups of participants.
Right. So if you have 100 people studying, say, anxiety treatments, you might put 50 in the CBT group and a different 50 in the control group. Then you compare the average anxiety levels of the two groups.
Okay, different people, different experiences. What about within subject then?
Within subject designs, sometimes called repeated measures designs, use the same participants in all conditions.
Everyone does everything.
Exactly. Imagine you have 50 people and you want to see if listening to classical music versus rock music affects concentration. In a within subject design, all 50 people would do a concentration task while listening to classical music, and they do the task while listening to rock music.
Oh, okay. Then you compare each person's performance under the two conditions.
Precisely.
That sounds efficient. You need fewer participants, maybe. But are there, like, downsides, potential problems with having the same people do everything?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Within subject designs have their own specific challenges, mainly grouped under the term order effects.
Order effects. Okay, what does that mean?
It means the order in which participants experience the conditions can actually influence their responses in the later conditions.
Just the sequence matters. Can you give some examples?
Sure. One is a carryover effect. Maybe the effect of the first condition hasn't fully worn off when the second one starts. Like if one condition was really tiring, they might still be tired during the next one.
Okay, like a hangover effect.
Sort of, yeah. Then there's the practice effect. People might just get better at the task, like that concentration task, simply because they've done it before, regardless of the music.
Ah, they learn the task itself.
Right. And the flip side is the fatigue effect. They might just get tired or bored doing the task multiple times, so their performance gets worse in later conditions just because of that.
Wow. Okay. So just the order you do things in can mess up the results. That seems like a pretty big hurdle. How do researchers deal with these order effects?
The main weapon against order effects is called counterbalancing.
Counterbalancing.
Yeah. The idea is to vary the order in which participants experience the conditions. The most thorough way is complete counterbalancing.
Meaning?
You figure out all the possible orders of the conditions and you assign different participants to each order. So if you have three conditions, A, B, and C.
Like maybe three different types of ads?
Yeah, good example. There are three factorials. That's 3 × 2 × 1, which equals 6 possible orders. ABC, ACB, BAC, BCA, CAB, CBA.
Okay, 6 orders.
So you'd need enough participants to divide them among those 6 different sequences. This works best, obviously, when you only have a few conditions.
Right, 6 orders isn't too bad, but what if you had like 5 conditions? That number of orders would get huge really fast.
Exactly. 5 factorial is 120. Complete counterbalancing becomes totally impractical. So in those cases, researchers often use something called a Latin square.
A Latin square, okay, what's that?
It's a more efficient approach. It doesn't use all possible orders, but it systematically arranges the conditions so that each condition appears at each position in the sequence, first, second, third, etc., an equal number of times.
Ah, so it's a way to balance things out without needing hundreds of different orders.
Precisely. It helps distribute the potential impact of those order effects more evenly across the conditions, even with a reduced number of sequences. It's a very useful technique when complete counterbalancing isn't feasible.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. That whole experimental toolkit is really fascinating. Now let's shift gears a bit. The other big category we mentioned was observational studies. How do these differ?
Right, observational studies. As the name kind of implies, these involve researchers observing and recording behavior as it naturally happens.
No manipulation.
No direct manipulation of variables like in an experiment. Because of that, they're non-experimental. Their main goal is usually description, painting a picture of what's happening, rather than nailing down a direct cause and effect link.
So less about actively intervening, more about watching and documenting what's already going on.
Exactly. And they can take a lot of different forms. They might be qualitative, focused on rich descriptions and interpretations.
Like detailed notes.
Yeah. Or they could be quantitative, where you're actually counting specific behaviors or using rating scales. And they can range from being really unstructured and open-ended to very structured and systematic.
Why choose observation over an experiment? What kind of insights do you get from just watching?
Well, they offer some real advantages. They're fantastic for understanding behavior in its natural habitat, you know, the real world.
Not just a lab setting.
Right. They're also great for looking at things that are hard to bring into a lab, like complex social interactions or nonverbal cues, facial expressions, body language, things that might change if people knew they were in an experiment.
Makes sense.
And they give you a window into people's actual experiences as they live them, how they react to things naturally.
So a more maybe holistic view. The materials mention two main types, unstructured and structured observation. Let's start with unstructured. What's that like?
Unstructured observation is really flexible. The researcher doesn't go in with a rigid checklist of exactly what to look for.
More open-ended.
Yeah, they tend to record pretty much everything they noticed. Verbal stuff, nonverbal cues, emotional reactions, the context. It's usually qualitative, and at getting a deep, descriptive understanding.
Okay, and within that?
Within unstructured, you got a couple of key types. One is naturalistic observation.
Naturalistic, like watching animals in the wild, but for people. Murdering kids on a playground, maybe?
Exactly. Observing behavior in its natural setting out in the field. And this can be done in two ways, disguised or undisguised.
Disguised means people don't know you're watching.
Right. Like maybe observing how shoppers interact with a new store display, assuming it's a public space where there's no expectation of privacy. Undisguised is when people do know they're being observed. Like your playground example. Maybe the researcher is sitting on a bench with a clipboard.
But then, doesn't that change how people act? If they know they're being watched?
It absolutely can. That's a major consideration called reactivity, or sometimes the Hawthorne effect. People might behave differently, maybe better, or just unnaturally.
Yeah, I can see that. Okay, so that's naturalistic. What about participant observation? That sounds more involved.
It is. In participant observation, the researcher doesn't just watch from the sidelines. They actually become part of the group or community they're studying.
They join in.
Yeah, they take an active role. And again, this can be disguised. Maybe they join a club without revealing they're a researcher, or undisguised, where they're open about their role from the start.
Wow. What's the benefit of actually joining?
The big advantage is getting a much deeper insider perspective. You understand the nuances, the shared meanings, the dynamics in a way an outsider might not. Think about someone joining, say, an online gaming community to understand its culture.
I see. But being part of it, could that bias the researcher or change how the group acts around them?
Definitely potential downsides. The researcher's own views could color their observations, or their presence, even if known, could alter the group's natural dynamics. It's a trade-off.
Okay. So that covers the more flexible, unstructured side. How does structured observation compare?
Structured observation is much more, well, structured. It's systematic. It often happens in a controlled setting, maybe a lab that's set up to look like a living room. But it can also be done in natural settings like a classroom.
But the key is it's more focused.
Yes. The focus is on quantifying specific, predefined target behaviors. You decide beforehand exactly what you're looking for.
Like how many times does the child share a toy?
Exactly. Researchers use coding schemes or checklists to tally the frequency or maybe the duration or intensity of these specific actions.
So less about the overall vibe, more about counting specific things.
Precisely. The upsides are more control, more specific, often quantifiable data, and it can sometimes be less time-consuming or expensive than long-term unstructured observation.
But the downsides?
Well, because it might be in a less natural setting, the findings might not generalize as well to the real world. That's lower external validity. And reactivity can still be an issue if people know they're being coded or checked off.
Right. Like that preschool example in the materials, watching kids during free play, but using a checklist for specific acts like sharing or aggression. It's structured within a natural-ish setting.
Exactly.
Okay. So whether it's structured or unstructured, it sounds like doing observational research properly takes some planning. What are the general steps?
Yeah. It's not just about showing up. First, you need to identify your setting or the group you want to study, and crucially, get permission if needed.
Right. Ethics.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Then you develop a protocol. This is like your plan. What's going to happen? What kinds of things will you be looking for or experiencing? Even space for your own reflections as a researcher. And if it's structured, you prepare your checklists or coding sheets here.
Okay, get the plan down.
Then you need to define your focus. What specific behaviors or interactions are you initially going to pay most attention to? And decide your role. Are you purely an observer or will you be a participant?
Observer or participant, okay. And during the actual observation.
Note-taking is critical. Really detailed notes, what you see, what you hear, maybe even what you feel. Nonverbal cues are important. Sometimes creating a timeline of events helps.
So capturing everything.
As much as possible, yeah. And afterwards, it's often useful to write up a narrative story of what you observed, including your reflections on it.
And then leaving this situation.
You want to withdraw thoughtfully.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a participant. Thank people if they knew about the study, maybe provide contact info.
Got it. Now, one more thing mentioned is the case study. How does that fit in? Is it observational?
A case study is kind of its own thing, though it often uses observational methods. It's a really in-depth investigation of a single instance, usually a person, but could be a group, an event, or a community, often focusing on something rare or unique.
Like studying someone with a very rare neurological condition.
Exactly. It's primarily descriptive and non-experimental, often qualitative and longitudinal, meaning it follows the case over time, but quantitative data can be part of it too.
So it's ideal when you can't really gather a large group for an experiment or a standard observation.
Precisely. It lets you explore complex situations in rich detail that other methods might miss, like the example of studying someone with a rare form of autism.
But I imagine you can't really generalize much from one person, right?
That's the main drawback. Case studies tend to have low external validity. What you learn from one unique case might not apply to anyone else. And because you're not manipulating anything or using control groups, you can't establish cause and effect. They're great for generating ideas or illustrating possibilities, but limited for drawing broad conclusions.
Okay, that paints a really clear picture. So we've journeyed through experiments with all their controls and variables and the more natural world of observational studies and case studies. Can we just quickly recap the absolute key differences?
Sure. I think the biggest one is manipulation versus observation. Experiments actively change something, the IV, to see its effect. Observational studies watch things as they are.
Causality versus description.
Right. Experiments aim for causality, trying to say A causes B. Observational studies are more focused on describing what is A like, or how are A and B related in the real world.
And maybe control versus naturalism.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Experiments often prioritize tight control to isolate the IV's effect that gives them high internal validity, confidence in the cause-effect link. Observational studies often prioritize studying things in their natural context, which can boost ecological validity, how much it reflects real life.
So really different tools for different jobs, answering different kinds of questions, both seem incredibly valuable for understanding behavior.
Absolutely. Neither one is inherently better. They just offer different kinds of insights. Understanding both and their strengths and weaknesses is really crucial for being a savvy consumer of research.
This has been super helpful, really clarifies the landscape. It gives you a much better lens for looking at research claims.
Okay.
So for you, the listener, as you think about all this, maybe consider this question. Thinking about these different ways of knowing experiments versus observation, how might the choice of method actually shape how we understand everyday things like, say, social media use or educational practices or even political trends? What kinds of questions does each method let us ask, and what might each method, inherently emphasize or maybe even miss? Definitely something to chew on.